All right, let's begin, and as others come in, they'll come in. So welcome to the late show, or the late session. David Letterman couldn't make it tonight, and you're stuck with me. I'm Michael Pellett. I'm a pastor at King of Glory Lutheran Church in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada. And I also teach in the philosophy department at the Catholic College, St. Thomas More, on the University of Saskatchewan.
Yay, Saskatchewan!
Thank you. And what I'm doing this week, in fitting with the theme of Holden, the many-colored grace of God, is a short history of grace, which is an undoable topic,
yes.
But we're doing it anyway. And what we'll be doing is looking at five different ways that grace has been interpreted, understood, put into action within the history and tradition of the Christian Church. And yesterday, fitting with the 4th of July theme, we kind of forgot the timeline completely and went right to the contemporary period and looked at theologies of liberation and their view of grace. And so now we're going to go back and look at both Hebrew and Christian scriptures for some of their understandings of grace. And indeed, we'll see how there's even a shift in grace from Hebrew scripture to the Christian New Testament. Tomorrow we'll look at Augustine and his understanding of grace, and then Thomas Aquinas, and on Friday we'll wrap it up with Luther. And of course, again, there are many others that could be included, but those are the ones that are chosen. So tonight, as we look at the biblical words for grace, and again, if you're close to a Bible, or there's a few Bibles here yet if you don't have one, because we will be looking in our Bibles, and this is not officially the Bible study, but you know, Bible study in the morning, Bible study in the evening, perhaps more Bible study than humans should have, but we're going to go with it. So just to start out, okay, our topic, our word is grace, and of course there are different Hebrew and Greek words for grace, and we'll look at the main ones. But the interesting thing is the way in which they are translated within our scriptures, right? In terms of our English translation. And of course, it's not always, grace is not always translated as grace, but it's translated as some other words as well. So can you think of some synonyms or other words that are in the New Testament that might also try to interpret or translate this word grace? So we are playing the I am thinking of a word game.
Mercy?
Mercy? Yes.
Love?
Love?
No.
Charity.
Charity.
Charis.
Charis,
but it's not
as love.
Forgiveness.
Forgiveness. No. Isn't this fun?
Is that the $200 question?
Anybody want to call a friend?
You.
Any other?
Peace?
No. All right.
Mercy
is the most, besides grace itself, mercy is the other word and the most common for grace. Another one that's very common, favor. And the next, I'm surprised no one came up with this one. It's not love. It doesn't count as love. But the specific term, steadfast. love, which is different than charity, right? So that's why that one would, I ruled that one out. Another one is faithfulness, truthfulness, generous undertaking, and we're not referring to morticians here.
They're not generous.
And freely bestowed.
There's nothing about prayer before a meal.
True. Those, it, besides the word grace itself, of course. Oh, and there's one more that shows up in a few places. Thanks.
That's the grace before me.
So there are your synonyms, if you will, for grace as understood or as translated in both Old and New Testaments.
Whose faithfulness?
Huh?
Whose faithfulness?
Whose faithfulness? God's. A couple other statistics here, again, in terms of the most commonly used words for grace in the New Testament are charis and eleos, right? Usually translated here as mercy. And again, the interesting thing here, just a few statistics, neither of these terms show up in Mark's gospel. You won't find grace in Mark. Matthew uses the term eleos, or mercy, three times. No charis, no grace in that sense. John uses the word charis four times, and it's all in the prologue, chapter 1, verses 1 through 18. After that,
no more grace,
and no mercy ever.
Whoa.
Luke uses charis eight times, eleos seven times. Paul uses either grace or eleos 101 times. Would anyone like to venture a guess where we get our theology of grace from? Right? You can see right here the whole sense and the development of our notion from New Testament, how we understand grace is firmly entrenched within the Pauline letters. Okay, so let's get to some of the words themselves and some of the specifics here. First of all, within the Hebrew scriptures. And the first key term there, again I'll transliterate it, is chenan. And again, that is often translated as grace or favor. It comes from royal vocabulary. Chenan is what a benevolent king bestows upon his people. And so it's used in that context in terms of the way in which the king has mercy on the poor by giving them something to fill their need. Or by the king who, as the victor, lets off the defeated, right? Gives them amnesty. Or again, after a war, the king may bestow pardon. In that sense, chenan implies granting forgiveness, something which In classical Greek, the word charis didn't have as its notion, and we'll see why in a little bit. And that's why, in terms of the Septuagint, which is the translation of Hebrew text into Greek that was done first century BCE, the word they used for that was eleos, or mercy. And so very often when you come across the term mercy in the Hebrew Bible, it's for this sense of chenan, and it really is this sense of grace or of favor.
Right.
Again, the key thing to this is that it is to be gracious, to have mercy on someone. It is understood as a gift. It presupposes a lack.
Right.
You have a lack, and therefore I graciously give you whatever it is to meet your need.
Right.
So that's again why it would be like mercy or bestowing favor. Yes?
Does it have a material sense in the Hebrew? Does it have a sense that there's a material lack? You lack water, you lack food, you lack land? Or is it something less, more abstract?
It's both, right? Because again, particularly, right, the benevolent king will bestow upon the poor the kind of thing, you know, particularly food or clothing and those kinds of things. So that has the material sense that goes with it. Yes?
What's that different from charity?
Yes, because charity is going to come over in the New Testament, and it's going to have a little different sense. Charity doesn't involve this kind of thing of finding, you know, the disposition of the person is something in which you find favor. So we'll get to charity. Anything else about this term? One, again, for the sake of time, you simply look at one Bible passage here, Psalm 119, verse 29. If someone would look that up, please, and read it.
Put false ways far from me and graciously teach me your law.
Okay, right. Here again, Chanan, graciously teach me your law or Torah. And certainly as it comes to Hebrew thinking within Judaism, as it develops, of course, the most gracious thing which God could give God's people is Torah. They were in need of instruction of Torah, and of course, that is what God graciously provides. That's why, again, this gracious love of God, this gracious favor of God is always understood as covenant or covenantal grace. The best way in which God can bestow that upon people. Again, just a little word count. Chenan appears 69 times in the Hebrew scriptures, 43 times God is the subject, 26 times the term occurs in the Psalms, where God is not the subject, but indeed we are the recipient of this. So again, just the sense there. Another thing here is that this notion of grace, kenan, can be linked with mercy and also with steadfast love. Two examples, Exodus 34, verses 6 and 7. And again, if somebody
bless you.
Thank you.
would find that and read that. Exodus 34, 6 and 7. And if some other folks would look at Psalm 86, verses 15 to 17.
The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, "The Lord, Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation."
Okay, so this is the second time that God gives the law on Sinai, this appearance of God, this theophany of God, and we get the full whammy of grace, right? Merciful, gracious, steadfast love. The three key Hebrew words for grace right there. And the other thing to note is, in this, for how long will God be gracious? You remember?
Thousand generations.
And for how long, if you goof up, will God not be gracious?
Four generations.
Right? Gives you an understanding here of, yeah, I guess we got steadfast love. Contrasted to what we do not have, steadfast wrath. Mm-hmm. Four generations can pass away rather quickly, can't they? 1,000 generations, that's going to hang on for quite a while. That's God's steadfast love. That sense there. Psalm 86, 15 to 17, please.
But you, O Lord, are a compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger and abounding in love and faithfulness. Turn to me and have mercy on me. Grant your strength to your servant and save the son of your maidservant. Give me a sign of your goodness that my enemies may see it and be put to shame. For you, O Lord, have helped me and comforted me.
Okay, here's the example where these terms are used for the person who is to receive mercy and steadfast love. A psalm which is a supplication, asking, basically saying, God, I'm in need. I am needy. Show me your favor. Show me your mercy, your grace, your steadfast love. The way that that's used. Our next term, and we've already worked on some of that, is this sense of steadfast love. Hesed. And again, just a few interesting statistics. Hesed appears 237 times in the Hebrew Bible, 127 times are in the Psalms. One of the differences between Chenan and Hesed is Chenan is much more with the individual and the individual's disposition. The gracious king who shows favor, right? The individual, that disposition. Hesed, steadfast love, is more communal, interested more in relationships. It can be a bond or a relationship between a host and a guest. It can be between kindred, right? Between relatives and family or tribe. It can be between benefactor and beneficiary. It is, again, concerned with deeds of kindness and friendship with which there is no obligation and no expectation. Steadfast love is unpredictable
surprising acts of kindness. Again, we saw that in Exodus 34, verses 6 and 7. And again, think about that in terms of that surprising notion to say, steadfast love lasts a thousand generations. It's opposite four generations. You go, wow, right? One other example of steadfast love. This is Genesis 32, verses 9 to 12. And again, if someone would please read that for us. Genesis 32, 9 to 12.
And Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, return to your country and to your kindred, and I will do you good. I am not worthy of the least of all the steadfast love and all the faithfulness that you have shown to your servant. For with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I am afraid of him. He may come and kill us all, the mothers with the children. Yet you have said, I will surely do you good and make your offspring as the sand of the sea, which cannot be counted because of their number.
Okay, thank you. This is Jacob at the Jabbok before he meets his brother Esau, from whom he fled many years before, because after all, he tricked him into selling his birthright, and that did not make Esau a happy camper. And here again, it's a little bizarre, isn't it, that Jacob, you kind of get the sense he feels wronged and he's going to get into trouble, and of course, he's in need. Right? The big need is, please God, don't let my big brother kill me. And again, in order to make that supplication, and what? He prays to the God of his fathers, right? The God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, to remind him both of mercy and, of course, steadfast love. If you will, the claim is, you know, God, you saw Abraham, you saw Grandpa Abe through everything, and you saw Dad Isaac through it all. Stick with me as well. Right. And the sense here of grace, this sense of steadfast love, and again how it can also at that point then be understood as faithfulness, is because it is talking about God's stick-to-itiveness. There's no reason for God to stick with Jacob. Right? In fact, Jacob's really kind of a shady character all the time. Right? I mean, Yaakov means heel. He really is a heel. And, right, God sticks with him. Again, many times Israel does not act as God's people. And yet, right, God shows steadfast love. God sticks with them. You can think here of, again, this is an experience of dependability, faithfulness, reliability, security. And again, trying to think about how we would understand those that experience of grace. The other thing that's interesting in terms of words that are linked with Hesed is that the prophets link with Hesed the term Rehamim, which is often translated as compassion. And that's a fine translation, but again, interestingly, the root rehem literally means womb. And so that here again,
Chesed in Hebrew is a masculine noun. Rahem, obviously, a feminine noun. And the prophets just love to put those two terms together. Right? That in other words, one way of talking about steadfast love is it shows itself more specifically in a sense of compassion. It's like a mother's womb. Because certainly a mother's womb is a place where you can think of steadfast love, compassion, care for one that is totally dependent, totally needy on all aspects of life. And so, these two terms, steadfast love and compassion, are linked so often then within the prophets. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Hosea is probably where you find it in its most radical form, because Hosea is commanded by God, if you will, to marry a prostitute and to have children by her. And of course, again, a sign of steadfast love and compassion is what Hosea's life is supposed to demonstrate. In that sense, his life is a living parable, a living proclamation of God and God's steadfast love. Okay, what comes out of this? You have a very simple diagram. This is God, and this is us. Grace, whether that's Kenan, Hesed, the other, is always from God to us. Grace is not a mutual relation. It's a one-way relation. We're not gracious toward God, even if we think so. Our relation to God, and I use G words here just because it's a little mnemonic device so I can remember it, is gratitude. Our response to grace is gratitude or praise, right? That's why it shows up so often. God's grace in the Psalms, our response, gratitude, praise, thanksgiving. That's the vertical response we have to grace. The horizontal response to grace is generosity, which for the Hebrews is tzedakah, or what we would call righteousness. So that again, righteousness is not our relationship toward God. Righteousness is our response and relationship toward one another because of God's grace. Because of God's steadfast love. Because of God's favor. We are empowered for righteousness, for tzedakah, for justice, and all that that involves. Okay, I'm going to stop there. To give you a little summary of this here. God's grace or steadfast love is not understood to be merely an inner disposition of God, but God's dynamic love for people, revealed in acts which demonstrate that love in ways unexpected. Kenan stresses God's gracious presence to and concern for people, and especially divine solidarity with the weak and oppressed. Chesed emphasizes a love transcending duty, a love unmerited and overflowing in abundance. Human response to the God who has first loved humans is expressed in praise and thanksgiving to God and in righteousness and love for the neighbor. Right. So that this, if you will, is the sense, the dynamics of grace that's there. And again, all of this, right, grace here is not just concepts floating around out here. It's the sense of experience. So when we say God is gracious, we're talking about what God is doing, because who God is what God does. Right? God does grace. And God does it to you. Right? So that you can say, I've been graced. And again, indeed, if you have been graced, then gratitude and generosity follow. The experience of grace. All right, undaunted, we move on. That's everything you needed to know about grace from the New Testament. Our Old Testament. I'm sorry. Greek got the better of me there. It's all right. Charis is the most common word for grace, and you can see we get our word charity from that, which is the Latinization of this. Charis comes from the root char, and literally means that which sparkles or gleams. Hence, that which delights or attracts or gives pleasure. The word in English which we get from the root charis, from char, is what?
Charismatic,
yeah. But that's really derived from the Greek.
Charm.
Huh. Any of you have a charm bracelet? Mm-hmm. Or you're introduced to someone and they respond, I'm charmed. Right. Or to say, you know, well, you know, you live in such a charming little house. Right. Whatever, right? Charm, because what do we mean by charm? Well, a charm bracelet, of course, it might sparkle or gleam, but of course, it delights and gives pleasure. So that in classical Greek, you've got three basic words, or three basic understandings of charis. First, charis is that which brings joy. It is therefore attractiveness, charm, elegance. Secondly, charis denotes an affection, favor, care for someone. So you see, we're getting kind of close to that Hebrew understanding there. And third, charis evokes charis. In other words, gratitude in response to the gracious giver. Gratitude is what one can return to the donor, to one who gives. And so therefore, again, we're thinking about this as this sense about, first of all, the interesting sense there is joy. And again, you note within the New Testament, for example, let's say like the book of Acts, when the Spirit is at work and grace is given, or gifts of grace are given, the response of the Christian community is always that, right? They've got joyful hearts. What else could you have when grace is there, right? They are, if you want to use this term, they are charmed. Now what happens again is we think about this in terms of the two scriptures here, right? Within the Jewish understanding, as we said before, and this is particularly among the Jews of the diaspora, after Nebuchadnezzar raises Jerusalem and There's the exile, and the Jewish nation is no more. The temple is no more. They're scattered all over the place. The understanding there, as we said, the charis that they still have, that is with them, is Torah. The Christian claim, the charis that we have, is Christ. And so if you want to look at the, you know, the tensions that are there within the New Testament, you can say both the Jewish people and the Christian followers will hold to justification by charis, justification by grace. But is it by the grace of Torah, or is it by the grace of Christ? And of course, you see that argument carried through all over the place in the Pauline material, but particularly in Galatians and Romans. Right. Because there, Torah at times becomes nomos, law. Not always. I mean, Paul uses the term differently in different places. But certainly this is one of the keys, one of the things to think about there. Right? What Paul wants to tell us as he develops this, and again, this is throughout the New Testament and all the Gospels, even if they don't use the word grace, is this understanding that if we see Christ as grace, there is a new possibility for life. We have found favor with God and all that that indicates. Grace is a new life and a new way given by God in Christ. Often it's seen, particularly in John's Gospel and in the book of Acts, by the term the way, hodos, right? Exodus, the way out. But again, here the way is an oriental expression in terms of the way in which one conducts one's life. If you remember, in all the Gospels, there's that little phrase that we so often overlook. But in the Gospels, everything seems to happen while they're on the way. And we look that, you know, those are just kind of three filler words. No, these are key. On the way is precisely that whole experience of grace that is happening. And of course, before anyone was ever called Christians, they were known, as the book of Acts tells us, as followers of the way. And so, to see how we get this whole notion of grace without ever using the word grace, I'd like you to turn to John chapter 14, verses 1 to 7. And if someone would read that for us, please.
Do not let your hearts be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house there are many dwelling places. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, so that where I am, there you may be also. And you know the way to the place where I am going. Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you are going. How can we know the way? Jesus said to him, I am the way, and the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you know me, you will know my Father also. From now on, you do know him and have seen him.
Okay. Within our tradition, this text is used frequently for what occasion?
Funerals.
Funerals. Right. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. And then saying, I go to prepare a place for you. And most of us say, okay, well, that place, what is it? Heaven. Right? because, and this is, I think this is so neat, you'd almost think it's inspired. This sense of place. I'm going to write again for time. We could do this for the whole week, but to just rattle this off, to show you what I think John is up to. This is John chapter 18, verses 1 and 2. After Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples across the Kidron Valley to a place where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, because Jesus often met there with his disciples. Okay, there's a place. What happens at that place? Betrayal. All right. Then I want you to follow to chapter 19, verse 13. When Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus outside and sat on the judge's bench at a place called the stone pavement, or in Hebrew, Gabbatha. What happened at that place? Judgment. Verse 17 of chapter 19. And carrying the cross by himself, he went out to what is called the place of the skull, which in Hebrew is called Golgotha. What happened at that place?
Crucifixion,
or we'll just generalize say death. Verse 41 of chapter 19. Now there was a garden in the place where he was crucified, and in the garden was a new tomb in which no one had ever been laid. What happened there?
Resurrection.
No, burial. John could have just said, you know, they went to Gabbatha, they went to Golgotha and all of that stuff, but it was always a place, a place. Jesus says, I go to prepare a place for you. Not heaven. Why? Because these are the places where we need grace. Because all of us in our lives are going to be in places of betrayal and places of death and places of judgment and places of burial. And we're going to be needy. And in those places, we will find favor in God's eyes. God's steadfast love, God's grace will be in these places. And Jesus is preparing these places by himself going there and being betrayed and judged and killed and buried. And therefore, we need never be in any of these places alone. What could be more gracious? Right? When Jesus says, I go to prepare a place for you, I'm the way, truth, life. It's because you're going to need a little life when you're in this mess. Right? That's what I think is going on here. Again, as I said in the other, heaven's not a problem. Right? What's important for the gospel, for grace, for Christ, is we need Christ now in this life. Heaven, piece of cake. So don't worry about that. It's how you're going to get through now. As some of you famously know, given the fact that it's always another day of disappointment and despair. I need the gospel now. I don't need it in heaven. I'll probably not be quite as disappointing and despairing, right? Now, when I face betrayal, judgment, death, burial, that's when I need a gracious God. And that's what Christ does for us. Prepares that way for us. That's where grace shows up. All right, a little bit of Paul on grace and some of the key things here. Romans 8, well, maybe I should. Any comments on that? I mean, if we don't finish, we don't finish. We'll all be gracious. Any comments people want to make on John 14 and then, you know, the other references there? Yes, please.
Given the 13 before that with the love and going on into 15 and the abiding with each other, does that say something about John sees us also in that God role for each other, that we're not alone because God's with us, but we're also not alone because we, the community, are.
Because the community, because there again, that same notion, right? If grace comes down this way, gratitude goes toward God, and of course, in John's gospel, instead of talking about generosity or righteousness, that's the notion of love, right? Love one another as I have loved you. So all of those, your chapter 13, 15, the foot washing that's there, you know, washing one another's feet, all of that comes out of that. That's right, yeah. It all hangs together for John. Any, yes?
How do you tie in this idea of the way through these places with that last phrase that's so problematical, the only way to the Father is through me?
Well, let's, you say, you know, yeah, no one comes to the Father except through me. Now, I mean, there's different ways of reading exception. So the question there is, do you see except through me in an exclusive way or in an inclusive way? Can there be a sense of except that's understood inclusively?
Sure. I think what they're saying there, you know, in retort to the event, the fundamentalists that are, you know, saying it's exclusive. I'm saying, I was just reading a little Borg and Crossan, that they say this is what that's talking about.
Yeah.
That the way to the Father is this difficult path through these hard places, and that is the way. And of course, that is open to anyone.
Yes. I think the other thing there again is when Jesus says, I'm the way, truth, life, those three terms again are like synonyms. And the thing here again is that the whole understanding of who Jesus is to be so bold and to say, Jesus is the event of grace. Right? Emphasis here on event. In other words, again, there God has come into our world in such a way, in this happening of grace that takes place in Jesus, that enables and makes possible this gracious way for everyone. Right. So again, it's the understanding here to say, except through me, what Jesus is saying by this is an understanding that God's grace has become abundant and abounding for all in me. It's not placing it on the person that says, again, right, unless you accept Jesus as your personal Lord and Savior and all, none of this can happen, right? Because this is the subject of the sentence. We're not the subject. We have nothing to do with this, right? So that the except through me is understanding Jesus as this event of grace, and that event is for all. Anyone else? All right, we're going to move on then. Yes.
How else could the Greek word for place be used? In what more ordinary sentences, what other context could you find that word?
Come over to my place.
So it's as ordinary as that?
A Greek word for this is topos.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Like topographic.
Topographic.
Okay. Thank
you. Yeah. And that's a very, very common word. All right, I would like you to look at Romans chapter 8, verse 32, please. And if someone would read that.
He who did not withhold his own son, but gave him up for all of us, will he not with him also give us everything else?
Okay. So what word in there is grace? Will he not also give us everything else? I think is how you read that, right? That will he not also give is the verb charistatai. There it is. Our favorite word, grace. It's basically, will God not also grace us with all things? That here again, you know, to use grace as a verb kind of is not very good English, so you understand why the translators are doing what they're doing. But again, it's this notion here, grace, again, is not stuff. It's not a thing. That quite frankly, it's much better to understand grace as a verb than as a noun. Because it's what God is doing, right? God gracing us, graces us with Christ, with all things. And again, particularly in Paul, words that are sometimes translated as give or thanks or whatever are really, again, verbal forms of grace. Right? Or again, Philippians 2, verse 9. Someone, please. Philippians 2, 9.
Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, that wasn't a question.
But you can be every name. So that what you're saying is, where's the grace on
yes,
there?
That's what I intended.
Okay, where do you think grace shows up in there?
Bestowed.
Bestowed. That's right. He didn't bestow on Christ. He graced Christ with that name. So in other words, again, to give you what Paul is trying to say here is that God, by raising Jesus, graced significance to the cross. From God's side, Jesus' communion with God is graced. It is the manifestation of grace to Jesus, a grace that moves from the cross through to the resurrection. Or again, another said, we get this so often in Romans, we are not under law, but under grace. Right? That same kind of understanding is there. Right? Again, let's look at this. Galatians 1, verses 15 and 16. To see the dynamics, how Paul understands this in his own life. And again, anyone, please read it.
But when God, who had set me apart before I was born, and who called me by his grace, was pleased to reveal the Son to me in order that I might preach him among the Gentiles, I did not immediately consult with anyone.
That we can stop you. That's okay. Great. Right. But again, that sense.
End of 16.
Right. Called me through his grace. And then again, he wants to know that that's the only way God works. That's why he said, I didn't consult with anybody else. You know, all those big deals up there in Jerusalem, I didn't need them. I didn't need them. Why? Because I got grace. That comes from God, and that's what counts. Right. And so, again, the whole point here, if you will, in Romans as well as here in Galatians, one of Paul's key arguments is to show the God of the Hebrew Scriptures, who is gracious and incarnates this grace in the cross and resurrection of Messiah Jesus. And that the problem with what he calls the Judaizers of his time, if you will, is that they have eclipsed this grace by legalistic structures. Structures to which he himself had succumbed and from which God has graciously rescued him. And of course, we too all succumb to our own legalisms of various kinds, right? Gentiles are not exempt. And we all, too, need to be called through God's grace, shown in the cross and resurrection of Christ. Okay? So therefore, right, that sense here, again, is that if we are justified by grace, called through God's grace, we are no longer under shame. Right? The key thing here for Paul, what is our problem again? What is our need? The problem is shame, not guilt. Right, the Norwegians weren't the only one, but they're really good at guilt, but so are a lot of folk. But you know, take it back to Genesis 3. There's old Adam and Eve in the garden, and they get a little uppity and munch away on the fruit, and trouble. And they make fig leaves for themselves. Why? Because they were ashamed. It's not because they felt guilty. Big deal. Shame is the problem. Right? Think about Paul as he starts out in Romans and that, right? I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. Right? Why is shame so closely connected with sin? What's the problem with shame?
Turned inward.
You're turned inward. What else is there with shame? Think about that, your experience. Have you ever experienced shame? Have you ever been shamed by someone? What's the problem with that?
You're paralyzed.
You're paralyzed. What else?
Isolated.
What else?
You feel like you're a terrible person.
You feel like you're a terrible person. Right? If I say to you, you ought to be ashamed of yourself.
I'm going to go crawl in the hole now.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you're really not even deserving of being a member of the human race.
God thought so. But God thought so.
But God thought so. Right? That whole thing that while you are shamed in everyone else's eyes, for some reason you have found favor in God's eyes. Basic understanding of grace, right? Why would God find favor in you? I don't know. Right? That, if you will, that's the, in that sense, grace is the mystery of God. Or Paul's way of putting it in terms of this, right? While we were yet sinners, while we were ungodly, grace came. Right? It wasn't get godly first. It wasn't shape up, wear a tie, and then I'll think about it. No! Even when you didn't wear a tie, God was gracious.
I shouldn't pick it.
Right? That kind of thing. Right? While we were sinners, ungodly, in shame and ashamed, like Adam and Eve in Genesis 3, that's when God comes. That's the experience of grace. And so again, you can think about that. Think about Jesus in the Gospels as he's going to the outcast, the unclean, the impure, the sinners. These are all people for whom the righteous are going, right? Shame, 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 shame. And while in that shame, Christ comes to them and says, you have found favor in my eyes, in God's eyes. Come, you are welcome. Right? That's the understanding of grace, and of course, that's what Paul tries to understand and make clear in his sense of grace as well. Again, just we'll conclude this here. The one who has favor, namely God Christ, renders favor to the one who needs it. Not for something in return, nor for the sake of the one who renders it, but for the sake of the other. And it is therefore grace is an expression of gift or freely. It is an adverbial expression, right? Freely given, graciously given. Yes?
The rules of gift-giving in human cultures imply a reciprocity. So in the Greek, this is without the obligation of reciprocity, with no possibility of reciprocity.
Right. If you want to do reciprocity, then we go Dorian, giving gifts, all of that stuff. That's a whole, that kind of gift-giving reciprocity or something in the Greek, as in the Hebrew, would be a different verb. So we're using verbs here that aren't talking about reciprocity, and that's why in that little diagram, grace is not a reciprocal or mutual relationship. It's one way. God to us, the response, gratitude, generosity. But that, no, that's not reciprocity.
Is it always slightly shocking, unexpected, impossible to predict?
Probably. Right? I mean, I think that's the understanding.
It doesn't seem reasonable.
I think, oh no, it's not reasonable at all. That I can be confident in saying. But I mean, I think, right, that's why the parables, because they are trying to talk about this gracious action of God, is always shocking. Right? Easy one. Parable of the lost sheep. Who of you having 100 sheep and losing one leaves the 99 and goes after the one? Well, nobody. We're not nuts. Right? I'm going to risk 99 sure thing for the one dumb sheep? You know, it's a tax write-off. Right? Come on. Only, right? That's shocking. That's surprising.
Yeah.
That's unheard of.
Irrational.
Who would, you know, what entrepreneur would act that way, huh? That kind of thing. Anyone else? All right. We're going to stop because the time said so. Thank you for graciously enduring.